right, welcome back to Why Are We Like This, the podcast that treats Florida like the active crime scene it is. I am your host, David Quinones. I'm joined, as always, by my co-host, Tomas Kennedy. Hello, Tomas.
Hello. What's looking up?
Good.
In the recesses of the swamp in Miami, back again.
We're going to get into it. And if I'm joined by Tomas, that means I am also joined by my other co-host. His favorite part of Civil War was when Spider-Man showed up. Hey, Gerald Bowerdy.
Hey, yeah. We were discussing about the Civil Wars that are fictional and the ones that only feel fictional. So I'm getting excited to jump into that today.
So we're going to talk about the movie Civil War today. That's our main topic. But we, before doing that, we wanted to, that fun topic. Before that, we wanted to catch up with a lot to catch up on. The drama surrounding the Miami-Dade Democrats, the efforts to find new leadership in this seemingly rudderless local party that is also governed by a rudderless state party that increasingly is at the whims of a rudderless national party that, yeah, we could just keep going. Anyway, for those who are not initiated and who don't know what's going on, a friend of the show, Billy Corbin, was graciously, kindly, out of the kindness of his heart, offering his services to be a figurehead, a leader for this party. And he was running for the chairmanship. And that didn't go great, as you could probably imagine. Intervening week days, I should say hours, since the Miami-Dade Dems held a sort of a kangaroo debate, Billy has withdrawn his name. He says run for a full term as a leader in later this year after the election, and I think that his chief concern was the party and everybody involved in it, everybody involved in a leadership level, their unwillingness to accept where things are right now, which is that things are bad right now. And instead, we just keep hearing a lot of paeans to, let's just get to work, guys. Hey, it's a lot of stuff to do. And nobody really seemingly wanting to grapple with the disarray that the brand of Democrats is in, not just in Florida, but in Miami-Dade, where Democrats used to be a pretty solid majority. And I don't know, Tomas, it's you're down visiting right now, but I've been here and it just has felt like really depressing to see all of this. Obviously, you know, you were aware of the proposed transparent, open, public debate that Billy had had put on the books to happen at Gramps last Wednesday, a couple days ago, that ended up not happening. I don't know, man. What's your take?
Yeah, and we'll have Billy Corbin on probably in a upcoming episode to talk to him about this. David, I'm so tired. I'm so tired of this fucking topic. I'm so tired of the Florida Dems, the Miami Dems, and their Taylor Swift reels. Nothing against Taylor Swift. You know, I've defended her on this podcast, but I'm just so tired, dude. Like, but anyway, so, you know, it's just so exhausting and pathetic. But basically, yeah, the after the ouster of Robert Dempster, there was going to be a coronation or so-called coronation of State Senator Chevron Jones, who was running unopposed. And, you know, it was obviously part of just like a choreography of sequence of leadership, right, into the structure of the Miami-Dade Democratic Party Executive Committee. And, you know, Billy decided to throw his hat in the ring, as he says, to give people options, start a conversation, and, you know, discuss what I think he delineated pretty clearly in the debate that did happen, a Zoom debate closed from the public, where journalists were banned from covering, which of course they covered anyways, because of course they got in. And of course the Miami-Dade Democrats eventually posted it on their YouTube channel after being shamed repeatedly for it. But yeah, the Miami-Dade Democrats is not an infrastructure that can support and recruit candidates. It's an infrastructure that recruits clients for a consultant monopoly, a consultant cartel, right? And it's become, you know, just a giant grift that can't win elections, can't, you know, really do anything. And we're all hurting because of it, you know, because it's perpetuating this one party state run by quasi-fascist morons at almost every level now, right? But yeah, in terms of, you know, what happened with this debate, Billy unilaterally organized a public debate at Gramps, the bar in Wynwood. You know, he talked to Senator Jones about the debate. Senator Jones agreed to do it, I guess, without asking too many questions for it. And Billy, you know, as he explains it, recruited three former chairs to moderate this debate. Former Representative Joe Geller, who happens to be Miami-Dade Democrats' school board candidate. Former Senator Annette Tadeo, who happens to be Miami-Dade Democrats' clerk of courts candidate. You know, so these aren't fringe people. And former chair Robert Dempster, who, you know, was recently removed, but, you know, like, this isn't, you know, like the Red Terror, right? Like, we don't erase people out of history.
This isn't a struggle session. This isn't, yeah, like,
At least we hope not, right?
I just want to add like a little context to what Tomas is saying. This is a lot for those of you out there that are like, well, what? This is a debate.
Everyone's like, what the fuck is going on? And
this is one of those situations that the closest thing that I can that I can use to explain it to folks is like, if you've had that group of friends where like you want to go out, hang out, do something, you want to go take a vacation together, and nobody gets off their ass to do anything, and then finally you're like, hey guys, I went and I found a price for us to go to San Juan, or I found a price for us to go to Jamaica, and start setting it up, and you start like work. That's kind of the position Billy was in, because these people don't fucking do anything. They don't like, they won't get off their ass to do it themselves unless they're literally shamed into doing it publicly. And it was a very fraught process, I think, throughout the whole planning period.
You know, it's just crazy, man. I'm just speechless to everything that I have I've witnessed from afar. But, you know, going back to the moderators thing, you know, I believe Senator Dwight Bullard was asked to moderate this debate before Robert was asked. Because, you know, I think there was, you know, as Billy explains it, the desire was to have, you know, demographic representation, right? Joe Geller is white, Tadeo is Hispanic, Bullard and Dempster are both black, and Bullard and Dempster are the only black chairs who are alive of the Miami-Dade Democrats. But, you know, Bullard wasn't available, so the next person asked, and the only person to ask, I guess, was Robert. And, you know, the inclusion of Robert, as we've outlined in this podcast, you know, is controversial because a bunch of people hate him for no fucking reason, in my opinion. And yeah, the Miami-Dade Democrats basically did everything to not have this in-person fun public event, which both candidates had agreed to participate in. And instead they had this Zoom only closed from the public forum. Which was presided, by the way, by the acting chair, who, you know, was not elected. She was appointed to that position after Robert was removed, and who endorsed Chevron Jones in an election that she's presiding. I mean, you know, like...
if anything was going to be controversial, you'd think it would be that. You would think it would be, you can't moderate a debate where you've announced who your favorite candidate is.
Look, you know, like, I'm not trying to assume worse intentions, but if you're going to endorse in an election that you're presiding, the proper thing to do is to recuse yourself from that process, because it gives the appearance of favoritism. Like, this isn't fucking complicated. Anyways, the whole thing blew up. There was just, you know, like, this is just so boring and annoying and the same story over and over again. But there was a 2-week-long period of just a barrage of negative stories related to how, you know, the Democrats tried to rat fuck this process to, you know, keep the choreography and try to, you know, negate any external factors that might throw, you know, any sort of, you know, surprise into the mix. And Billy ended up withdrawing from the race. Yeah, withdrawing from the race. And, you know, the election is on Friday, and ultimately it's not very consequential. And if you're listening to this, you probably shouldn't care about it too much.
Gerald, we were joking before Tomas joined about, like, you were giving me like a little bit of insight about like what it looks like when a normal Democratic party does this.
The county party in Rockland is not exactly a powerhouse. I'm not going to say that we like influence major decision making, but for the chair, there was like 600 people who turned out for their chair
in person,
in a public place where you could just, you know, just beat show up. To me, what I glean from this is just how desperate they were to avoid having anything in public until it was posted on YouTube after the fact. It speaks to an unhealthy party. Like, if you have things worth celebrating, you would want people seeing how you operate. You would want people, you know, to feel part of, you know, the operation. But instead, it's this very like smoke and cloak rooms, and, you know, don't ask too many questions, and we need to make sure that the right people are asking the right questions. So to me, just the trying to get out of it, trying to, you know, make it a private event, Zoom only, internet only, and then post it after, you know, that to me, I think if you're listening, this tells you everything you need to know about what this process was like, was how desperate they were to keep you from participating in any even inconsequential way.
To your point, Gerald, another problem that was brought up by numerous members is that the election is being held during Shabbat in the middle, yes, of Passover week, which is, you know, excluding a bunch of Jewish members, right, that can't participate, right? I mean, you wouldn't do that during Ramadan to Muslim members. You wouldn't do that on Good Friday to, you know, Catholic members. Yeah. You should, you know, and honestly, I think it could open the party to a lawsuit, in you know, because of religious discrimination. I mean, that's not far off to say. And also beyond that, like, who the fuck schedules something this boring and annoying to go to on a Friday at 7 p.m. at any point
of
the yearly calendar? You know, like, what the fuck? I mean, I wouldn't. Would you guys? Friday?
No, Friday night. No. Thursday is the closest I would get it to a weekend.
I'm old and I'm a dad, and I wouldn't do that.
Yeah.
So, like, it's been very instructive to be friends with Tomas Kennedy and to learn how to kind of view some of the discourse around things like this. And one of the ways that I view it, as a result of being friends with UT, is that, like, everybody that I see who's like so opposed to the ideas that Billy is bringing to the table, or just his candidacy in general for this position, to blanch at the idea of there being an audit into where all the money is going that gets bandied about. Everybody, when you see them posting on Twitter, or you see them quoted in, you know, Herald or New Times articles, and you just do a cursory Google search to their LinkedIn, and you see that, again, we've talked about this before on the show, how this enormous state party has only like what, one or two actual paid positions, but all of these people are former chair or former or current executive director of some fucking nonprofit or some company or some agency or some communications firm or consultancy or something that, you know, is reliant on contracts, reliant on the state party or the Democrats or just being in good standing with somebody like Nikki Fried. And you can't help but notice it, that it's all coming from the same. I mean, like, you call them the consultant class. I think that's a great way to describe
cartel,
them.
Cartel.
The consultant cartel. And they're also fucking afraid of the boat being rocked and people starting to wonder, hey, where did all that money that we paid you for engagement and for outreach, where'd all that go over the course of the last three or four election cycles?
Look, David, you know, without, you know, getting too into it, everybody knows where their bread gets buttered, right? And my bread never got butter there. You know what I mean? I very intentionally never taken a dollar from the Florida Dems, the Miami-Dade Dems, or any of their candidates and campaigns, right? And that's why, I'm independent. You know, I can say whatever I want to say because I've designed my life that way. And that's not to put myself in a pedestal or whatever. And that's not to say that anybody who gets paid or works there is bad, because that's not true either. But, you know, everybody knows where their bread gets buttered. And I'll leave it at that.
Now, we got to, for our listeners out there, can you guys help us out with, like, send us your ideas on Twitter or Instagram for what we would name Tomas's consulting firm? Because I think we're getting to that point where Tomas is going to have to all of a sudden come on the show and be like, guys, guess what? Nikki Fried, she's actually great. And I have a big announcement.
Yeah, this is actually just a 9-year horrible tactic campaign to get the Florida Dems to finally pay me something, and it's just not working.
Oh my God, Kenny, I've got it. It's perfect. It's Nikki Fried, in a very cynical way, will be like, you know what? We need one. I need to be allied with one leftist who, like, I just need one, and to be able to say that I have appeal to them. And so we will name your firm, like in the very sort of portmanteau-ish way that NBA players get their nicknames, Token, Thomas Kennedy, Token. And you'll be the Token leftist, yeah.
Wait, Token with already, two N's.
Did you have that already prepared? Or did you just come up with that on the fly?
No, I just came up with that right now, actually.
That's very good, David.
Thought of that. I hadn't thought of it before. It just hit me.
I mean, look, I'll give a little snippet of private conversations, but you know, right before, I resigned from the party in January via an op-ed in The Intercept outlining my opposition to, you know, the genocide in Gaza. But, you know, I had really bad relationships with the party structure for a long time, you know. And, you know, Fried actually, when the cancellation of the Democratic presidential primary happened in Florida, right? We were not able to vote for any other option except from Joe Biden. We're not able to vote at all. And that led to the municipal election debacle we saw a few weeks ago because turnout was so low. I mean, this has all been documented in the press and the media, whatever. You know, Chair Fried actually texted me and was like, hey, can you actually like help me, you know, like calm down some of the progressives who are complaining about this? And I was like, no, what the hell?
They're right.
I was like, they're right. And I've been like posting and writing about this, about how not only is this wrong morally, but it's electorally stupid, you know? And that conversation, I think, really annoyed her. And then I ended up resigning like a few, you know, like this was in November of last year. I ended up resigning, you know, in the first week of January, you know? But never too late to start up Token, my new consultant.
Hey, fellow progressives, maybe we've been too tough on Joe Biden. So from state and local party leadership that should be a crime to an actual state crime that has happened. I wanted to mention this story to you guys. Usually we don't get into like these kind of articles because like they're always so hyper local and they just happen, like, you know, even the most interesting crime in Florida is something that just is like, you know, somebody in Destin burns down their house that turned out to be a meth lab or something like that. But like, this is actually a story that I found to be really compelling and interesting. This is from the Miami Herald. A lot of people have written about this though, written by David Goodhue and Gretel Aguila. And the headline is Fourth Arrest into Homestead Woman's Central Florida Fatal Carjacking Investigation. Mm. And I just thought this was like a wild, I don't want to read the whole thing because we could probably do a whole episode on it, but basically I'll read the lead. A man believed by investigators to be perhaps the last person a Homestead woman spoke with before she was carjacked, kidnapped, and murdered in the Orlando area has been arrested. This is the fourth arrest in a sprawling multi-county, multi-agency investigation into the April 11th death of Catherine Altagracia Guerrero de Agua Viva. The 31-year-old mother of two and Homestead resident was found shot to death inside her torched white Dodge Durango. Now, this all came out of like a kind of like a viral video that somebody captured of her being carjacked. And it looked at first like a very strange carjacking because it was done like the woman, Catherine, being carjacked was like kind of compliant in a weird way. Like, and it has grown from this viral video to this weird situation where it's like this state spanning drug cartel situation.
Like multiple countries now, right?
Multiple yeah. countries. It implicates several police officers and state what? Troopers. And it's like
law enforcement is involved.
I know, so weird, right? And Florida law enforcement, the bastion of integrity. So I just thought that it was a fascinating story. I really recommend everybody reading it. We could, you know, this is just our news and notes section. We could probably spend 30-40 minutes talking about this. But yeah, her home was raided. They found a home was raided that where they found drugs, cash, guns. This is like really like some Florida flavored Breaking Bad shit. Yeah. And it was just a really fun story to read, to remember that there's petty fun crime happening out there that has nothing to do with politics, I suppose. But I don't know, did you guys get a chance to read this this article?
I took a look at it. Yeah. I mean, my understanding is they have two people in federal court right now looking at obviously life in prison and the $250,000 fine. I'm trying to piece it together in my head. And I think it's just wiser for me to wait for more information to come out. Because like you said, like it looks like there's a lot of implications, but I don't know how it all threads together. So it's something that, you know, I'm going to be paying attention to and see how it develops. So I don't want to get, you know, the cart ahead of the horse on it, but it is very wild to read.
Yeah, there was a behind the scenes sort of coordination with a cop who was pretending to be a detective,
right.
Estrella Chacon. He was hired by Orange County back in September 22. He was never a detective.
Fake it till you make it. Am I right?
Yeah, fake it.
That's for the job you want.
The victim in this case was in her car and called her husband and was telling him like shit's going bad, shit's going wrong, and they didn't call any cops for a very long time. It's just a really crazy story, and
it's like the Kanye song, "Yes, I'm going down."
The other thing I wanted to talk about before we talk about civil wars is like we beat up on Joe Biden a lot, and honestly, I've been pretty transparent that I'm not going to vote for him.
He beats up on a lot of college students, and
yeah, he beats up on a lot of college. I just wanted to share a personal experience I had. I don't think I've ever told you guys about this, but like when my wife and I were at the position, we were newlyweds, we were just about to get start our family and like buy a house and do that, all that stuff that comes when you're like in your back, well, used to come back in the early, you know, 2010s before it became cost prohibitive, all that stuff that you're starting to do when you become a family, we had to put on hold for a couple of years because I got fucked over by a rich guy who lied about a non-compete agreement. And without getting into all the details of it, I had a job on the line. I was accepted to the job. I got hired and it was going to be like triple the salary. It was my first big boy salary, my first grown up salary. And I got fucked over because I live in Florida, and Florida is the worst state for non-competes, to be a party to a non-compete, particularly as an employee. And the FTC has effectively this week outlawed them going forward. I think there's still a lot that's going to come of it. I wouldn't be surprised if the Chamber of Commerce finds a way to kneecap this. But anyway, I just wanted to bring that up, that's a good thing. Like, non-competes suck. Florida is the worst state for non-competes. And fuck non-competes. And it's good that they're gone. I can't believe we just like lived for so long with this like random thing out there where even if you're just like a pharmacist or a nail salon technician, like you could have to forego either your community where you live or your profession for like 2 years after you quit a job or after you get fired from a job. I don't know if you guys have any thoughts on that.
That's good. But then, you know, it's like, oh, wow, this is a good thing. And then I, you know, happened
to live
15 blocks away from Columbia University where, you know, there's students, you know, and professors are getting, you know, violently repressed. And, you know, across universities in the country, educators and, you know, students are getting the shit beat out of them by these, you know, militarized, you know, police thugs. So still in the fuck Joe Biden train, David. Sorry. Yeah,
still there. I'm still with you.
The subject of the non-competes, though, Tomas and I were actually talking about this subject after the movie where, I won't say who, but I had a friend who went in for a job interview and they let him know in advance it was a one-year job and then 1 year that he wouldn't be able to go work for a competitor. And he was asking who but a rich kid could afford to work. Like that's like as a social screener of just making sure we'll make it so onerous to work for us that only people who already come from money and whose phone numbers and emails will be valuable to us would want to or could do this type of work in the first place. So even just as a socioeconomic screener, I'm glad to see that it hopefully goes the into the ash bin of history.
I love a mid-career gap year. Like where you're just like, yeah, I'm 30 years old and I'm just gonna take the next year off because I'm governed by a non-compete. It's fun.
Is this shit like actually enforceable? That's another thing.
That's the other question. I mean, I don't know. The non-competes were certainly enforceable. I hope that the rule against it is.
Yeah. The non-competes were absolutely enforceable. I spent over $15,000. My attorney at the time was not famous yet, but it was the now famous Katie Fang, who was on MSNBC and is like a liberal, like a talking head now. And she was my lawyer. And I just like the
low world, huh?
Didn't fucking help. I ended up was like $15,000 poorer. And it they just waited out the clock, and I had the job offer was withdrawn. See, the enforceability is a good question, Gerald, because like maybe it is, maybe it isn't, but like also non-competes are almost irrelevantly enforceable, where it doesn't matter what happens in a court of law because all that they're intended to do is to scare off the people, other job, which is what they did. They scared off my other job offer, and so that it was enforced basically. Without like extrajudicially, it didn't require any judicial.
It was enforced by the bank account of the employee, basically.
By the free market, baby. So. With that said, guys, let's get to our main topic. You guys really wanted to talk about this movie, Civil War 2024, directed by Alex Garland, which I just saw this week. You guys saw a few weeks ago, starring Kirsten Dunst, Wagner Moura, and Kaylee Spaney, who I guess is like the new hot starlet in, like, she's going to, this young girl is like the new.
She's good.
The new hot thing. So just a quick plot synopsis. We start off in New York, where we meet Lee Smith, who's portrayed by Kirsten Dunst. She's a war photographer of some fame who is on assignment covering the early stages of what is a new civil war in the U.S. and a protest that turns into a riot. She meets Jesse, a young aspiring photographer who takes a baton to the chops before a flag-wielding woman runs into the fray and commits seppuku and blows everybody up. Later, back at the media's hotel, we meet Joel, a cocksure reporter played by Wagner Moura, who you might know as Pablo Escobar from Narcos, and Sammy, an aging writer whose best days are behind him, played by Stephen McKinley, who you might know from Dune. They discuss their plan to take a circuitous route to D.C. in some contrived effort to interview the president, who is this incredibly... like ridiculously like divisive figure who we believe has become holed up in the White House under threat of assassination. They're joined on their journey by Jesse, which displeases the veteran Lee, who doesn't think she's ready. Along the way, the group encounters no sort of shortage of war crimes, crimes against humanity, and general indifference to the war by the American population. And we follow them on their merry way to DC for an explosive third act of the movie. I don't know, guys. What did you guys think of the movie?
Tomas, do you want to go first?
I really liked it, honestly. I know a bunch of people are criticizing it because it doesn't take any sides. I mean, obviously, the incoherent, effort by the Western forces of Texas and California is to throw a bone to either libs or MAGAs to see themselves in the movie. But like, come on, y'all. The movie was fucking lib coded. Like the fucking president, the first shot is the president being like, this is gonna be the greatest victory of all mankind, the greatest victory of every military campaign in history. And then there's like references to the FBI being disbanded, you know, just like live coded shit. But it wasn't, I don't think it was, you know, like beaten over the head of the viewer, which I think is good, you know? And, you know, I think personally, I know people think that, you know, we're in the moment where this election is going to determine the fate of American democracy. And obviously Trump is a tyrant, despot, wannabe dictator, but I have no faith or belief in the current state of American democracy where, you know, corporations and special interests control the political process, influence our elections, where we live in a kleptocracy, where any form of dissent outside of the consensus zeitgeist of the dominating narrative is met with legit, just violent, militarized police repression. Like, I think we're already there, and I appreciated a movie that actually, you know, spoke to like my cynical state of mind of where we are in, yeah, in like American politics and public discourse. And I actually felt really sort of, I don't know if the movie was intended to do that, but I identified with the mindset of the reporters and journalist that, you know, we're basically just like, we're just here to report on this, you know, and not to take sides in this, you know, civil war.
I thought it was good. I did not think it was a grand movie. In the beginning,
me neither. I didn't think it was like a master.
They're having this, I'm sorry to say, like very like expository dialogue laden conversation in a hotel lobby or, you know, cafe area with their internet uploading their news that they did. And they talk about how they're going to go on an epic joyride to really do the news by interviewing the president. And I think you really have to look at the previous scenes of the explosions, the, you know, the fatality. Someone runs in with carrying an American flag and sets off a bomb, and there's an explosion that goes off. I think you really have to be a journalist to get in the mind of someone who just experienced that event and thinks that the highest calling right now is to do the damn news in the White House by interviewing the fash president. So I, right off the bat, I'm like, okay, I'm along for the ride. I'm already here. I'm already in my seat. Let me see how this goes. They have a, like the classic, big child baby friend dynamic of, the established, photojournalist, and the aspiring photojournalist, and how the younger one comes into herself through this journey, which is very nice. Some of the music choices I thought were very just not right. They had this very high stake. Like I was on the edge of my seat, the shootout between the Western forces and the government. And I'm like on the edge of my seat, they're taking these very like impactful pictures. While this is going on, the battle finally comes to an end, and then they kind of have this like hip-hop music playing while they're like carrying out the dead, and just like, wow, damn, we really were there for this battle that just happened. It just like kind of throwing away everything that just happened. In contrast, it also has a scene that I think might be the best of in any movie I'm going to see this year. Jesse Plemons, whose name is not Jesse Pinkman, as I called him after the movie.
That's a character in Breaking Bad.
I messed up. Yeah.
I addressed Gerald as, yo.
Yeah.
But not only that, that's the character in Breaking Bad who kills Jesse Plemons' character in Breaking Bad.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Jesse Plemons in red glasses starts asking all of our protagonists where they're from. And the ensuing scene is probably the best thing you're going to see in a movie this year. So I would recommend people go see the movie, even just for that scene alone. I thought it was
chilling.
Really good. If you want to know like what is the rotting heart of the American character, it's really not going to be found in the White House. It's going to be found in that scene. And so I would recommend people go see it just for that scene alone. And then my only other thought was, is there a more underrated person in Hollywood than Kirsten Dunst? Because afterwards, Tomas and I were going through the movie she's done since Spider-Man 3. really no misses, and yet she doesn't get any buzz, any accolades. She did a fantastic job, I thought, in this movie.
She's a treasure. Like she's
very good.
Yeah, she was in a she was recently in a TV show that almost nobody watched that I couldn't recommend enough. It's called On Becoming a God in Central Florida, which is an incredible show that was based in the 90s. I think it's like the early 90s, and she basically is recruited into an MLM scheme at the bottom of the pyramid and quickly ascends and becomes like the best at doing MLMs in Central Florida. And it's a great show. It got canceled after one season, but it was a really good show. Yeah, she's killer. Look, all the performances are great. I agree. It's impeccably shot.
Yeah.
But it's kind of sad news for me because this is a guy who I really love, Alex Garland, and this I think was his first bad movie. He wrote The Beach, which is a book that I really liked when I was younger, and they turned into a good movie. A pretty good movie with Leonardo DiCaprio. He wrote 28 Days Later. He went on this run where he made Ex Machina, Annihilation, an FX series called Devs that I really loved that came out right at the beginning of the pandemic. Made a movie called Men, which was okay. And this, I thought, was his first bad movie. So it's tough when one of your guys has his first big miss. I just didn't think it had anything to say. It didn't introduce any real new ideas or anything like that. It War is Hell. Like Stanley Kubrick told us that, fucking, you know, Coppola, Oliver Stone, they've also showed us that war is hell. And it's weird now because it's Americans instead of, you know, people from, you know, East Asia, I guess. I did think that the idea of the politics being sort of like fungible and mobile and not even really mattering, I actually like that. I like that the Jesse Plemons and some of the scarier characters that you meet honestly didn't even give a fuck like what side you're on. Yeah. They're there for the violence, yeah. Which to your point, Jer, is like
that. Which happens in war, right? I mean, yeah. There's like regional warlords that operate independently of like the actual organized military forces.
Yeah. Exactly. And it's mostly, I think we heard about this a lot in Afghanistan. If you read a lot of reporting in Afghanistan, when these types of things happen, it ends up being a way to settle petty local grievances where it's like your neighbor owes you money. And so you, you know, call in an airstrike on him. You like, and it's like, and that's, you know, we see some similar things like that where, oh, those guys were caught. Well, isn't there, there's a scene that towards the beginning where some guys are purportedly caught looting. And one of the people who catches them and is torturing them is saying like, oh yeah, I knew him in high school. He was an asshole. And it's like, yeah, so this is probably what's going on. I thought that part was interesting, but I just didn't think that I thought it stepped up to the edge of a great idea and stepped back. There was this song that is probably best known as the it's a Leonard Cohen song called Nevermind, and it was probably best known as like the intro song for a really bad season of True Detective season 2. But if you listen to the lyrics of it, it's one of my favorite songs. It's about it's about this guy who was a combatant in some kind of a civil war that killed his whole family, and his side lost, like roundly defeated, crushed. And he quietly just embeds himself into the society of the winning side of the war and just decides like, never mind, I'm part of your side now, and lives out his life that way. And I thought that though the parts that were talking about the transferability of our politics and how, you know, forget about the politics, the transferability of our cultural sides, where it's just like, oh, well, you know, none of this really matters. I know that there's stuff happening in DC, but it, you know, locally, I just hate people who are Puerto Rican, right? Because my friend Dave, who's I think been on the show before, he told me that there was some scene or something where they established that that the Brazilian guy was actually Puerto Rican and from Central Florida. I missed that. Where they said that he's like from Orlando, he's a Puerto Rican guy.
With Jesse Plemons.
I must have missed it. I must have just not heard the line. But apparently, I thought that was pretty true to life. But it was just a little too tropey. I just didn't think it had much to say. But beautifully shot. Nothing that Alex Garland makes is not beautifully shot. It all looks great. And acting, he has incredible actors. But
I mean, look, ultimately, I think that's what also holds me back from being like, this was a great movie. You know, we've talked about what happens to the United States, you know, in its current trajectory. And you know, I think it's it's going to become balkanized, right? I mean, you're going to have these sort of increasingly independent state governments that are going to defy federal authority, you know, federal law, that are going to basically act as independent, you know, republics or countries. I don't think that it's going to happen as dramatically and as violently as depicted in Civil War, right? I mean, you need to make it exciting because it's cinematography.
It's a movie, yeah.
But I think, you know, eventually you're going to have, you know, states, you know, you're seeing it now, right? In the case of Texas, for example, where it's defying, you know, the supremacy clause and related to immigration enforcement at the border, you know, and I think it could happen also with blue states, you know, when Trump is in power. So I thought that was interesting. I mean, it could have been explored more, but then you have to get into the politics of it, which would have made the movie like annoying and dense. I think for a movie that focused on journalists and their cynicism and how the news have to be reported, you know, there's a line that Kirsten Dunst says that it's like, we just record things so other people can ask questions on it. And I think that's as far as it got in terms of actually dissecting and exploring the ethos and the ethics of journalism. It didn't have much to say about journalism.
No.
Which was, you know, like weird. And, you know, we were talking about this too. I shared a clip of an Alex Garland interview on our show, WhatsApp group, you know, and Eric Garland, I guess they were asking him about, you know, right-wing extremism, particularly on the Pod Save America podcast. And he said, the job of the American left is to win elections. It's solely to win elections against right-wing extremists and to basically remove right-wing extremists from mainstream political party and elected office. You know, and I looked at that and I said, look, no, the job of winning elections is the job of that particular political party. The job of the American left is to push for leftist aligned, you know, public policy, right? Like ultimately, right? So I thought that was a really odd way of putting it. And like, how do you define who's an extremist in, you know, American political life? I mean, obviously Trump is an extremist, but I think Biden is an extremist in terms of, you know, his foreign policy, definitely. I think what's happening in Gaza and the Middle East, you know, and abroad is extreme. You know, I think he is an extremist president, right? So that's pretty subjective in terms of what we're seeing as well. So, and it was really odd for him to do a media tour and take like that sort of like bold, you know, partisan stance when the movie, again, it was lib-coded, but took great lengths to appeal to both sides of the island. And actually, we're seeing that in terms of its audience, right? I mean, it's doing really well in Southern Republican states. And again, I don't have a problem with that.
It bears noting that this is the...
I like that the movie didn't beat me over the head, whether like, you know, this is a MAGA movie or a Liv movie or whatever. But it was just like weird. And it betrays that the movie was Liv coded, right? But yeah, I do think that ultimately what I'm trying to say is I think the movie like posited like a possible future for America if presented a bit dramatically, but ultimately it was like a really confused movie that was really fun, well-paced and beautiful to watch.
I will mention that to Tomas's point. This is A24's biggest box office movie ever of all time. 70 million, 45 million opening weekend. And it is very successful coming on the heels a couple of years ago of Everything Everywhere All at Once, which did very well. And obviously movies like The Whale, which, you know, didn't do that great in the box office, but like got, you know, a lot of
It's a nice palate cleanser from The Zone of Interest, which is one of the most pretentious pieces of shit I've seen in a very long time.
I will say also this, the not just the pacing, but the length of the movie. Jesus Christ, thank God. I finally went to movies. I saw a 2-hour film.
2-hour movie.
Yeah. Under 2 hours, an hour 49.
Yeah, wow. Bring back the tight sweet 90. Spot. Bring yes. back the tight 90 minutes. This movie was, I am so fucking sick of going to the movies, and I love going to the movies, but having to sit there for close to 4 hours. It's unnecessary and annoying.
Gerald, what do you think of the idea that a British, you know, generally like part of the liberal order, a guy like Alex Garland and people like that, to Tomas's, you know, what he brought up about what Garland's comments were, I can almost see, if you're outside of our political system and you look at what the quote unquote American left, what it is, the best you can really hope for is it keeping the worst part of America in check. And he doesn't care. He's a British guy. He probably doesn't give a fuck about our internists and shit. But like, he's like, can you guys just do me a favor and keep the worst people out of office? From his liberal foreign perspective, it probably is his biggest preoccupation.
You could take what he said about the responsibility of the American left and make it about the Nikki Haley voter, and it's the exact same thing. It is a conservatizing thing to say that your job is just to win elections to hold state power, but no question, to Tomas' point, about how you would wield power on behalf of, you know, a grand program that could actually heal a lot of the deep rot in the country, socially and economically. I thought that don't quit your day job, Alex. Just keep making movies. don't offer thoughts on political strategy. What you're saying is that you know, even if there is an American left in the country, that its job is basically to act as a buffer to a far right that would like to wield power and openly salivates about doing so. But if you're going if you're not going to say how power should be wielded, you are essentially the Nikki Haley voter of, you know, we don't want to become an ugly country. We just want to be a respectable place, whatever it is. In which case, you know, you could always just be you could go on the Never Trump podcast and make the exact same pitch. It's the same thing.
Mueller, she wrote.
I mean, I would say Eric Garland would have a prolific career. As an Atlantic.
I forgot about Eric Garland too. I was like, many damn Garland. Garland's on here.
All this lib talk is scrambling my brain. Alex Garland would have a prolific career as an Atlantic staff writer with these sort of political takes. Yeah.
Can we talk a little bit about the Atlantic brain poisoned losers who were complaining about like the accuracy of like who have obviously no fucking media literacy and were complaining about the accuracy of like the Western Alliance map and the veracity of like how these positions would each side with each other and like how, like, what a fucking way to miss the point. I mean, like,
Like, this movie set in the near future, like, I don't know, that's like comic book guy shit. It's corny to care about that. I don't know if they know this, but like Texas had like a Democratic governor named Ann Richards in the 90s, and like California gave us Ronald Reagan. Like, things change.
Things fucking change. Yeah. You know,
like, and who gives a shit? It's a movie. Like, who cares?
So I don't know. Gerald, did you have thoughts on that?
I'm not trying to sound petty. It's nerd shit. Like, that is not, you know, it's a fictional movie. You can apply a fictional lens to it. You don't need to get into the, actually the elves would never have signed a pact with the dwarves because of this page of this. Come on, guys. Are you not allowed to have fun at the Atlantic? Is that maybe they have a non-fun clause that the FTC should be looking into? That's sad. That's sad that you're paying adults to get into the weeds like that.
Can we also have so many thoughts about the photography and the journalism side of it?
The shots are impeccable. I mean,
But like, if you guys think back since the advent of Twitter, like some of the most impactful war images that we've seen don't come from news photographers. Actually, most of them don't come from news photographers anymore. I feel like that's this like ballyhooed sort of like mythological character that doesn't exist. Rolling Stone news photographer embedding with the, you know, for the siege of Baghdad. That shit doesn't happen anymore. Yeah. And I doubt it would happen like this.
The most celebrated war photographer right now, that actually was named, I believe, one of Time's most influential person of the year is, I'm going to butcher his name probably, but Motaz, the Palestinian
photographer. Yeah.
You know, and he doesn't work for Reuters. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But, you know, again, it's like I saw one review of the movie that was like complaining of like, oh, like, you know, like the characters that were not photojournalists, there were no scenes of them actually turning out copy. And it's like, yeah, because that's fucking boring.
Yeah, it's not boring.
Nobody wants to see them sit down in a laptop and write a story. Like, that's off screen, dude. It's a movie. But yeah, but I do think, David, to your criticism, right? Like, but I guess, you know, that would be the young character, right? Well, what's her name?
Jesse. Yeah.
Yeah.
By Kaylee Tramley, or I forget her name.
Yeah, she. And you know, I mean, I don't know if Alex Garland's intended it this way. And spoiler alert, right? But at the end, sort of like Kirsten Dunst's character, who's cynical and detached, sort of like regains her humanity through, you know, lived trauma, and actually saves Jesse's life. And in the movie, she told her, like, Jesse asked her, "Would you photograph the moment if I die?" And then as Kirsten Dunst dies saving Jesse's life, Jesse sort of photographs the moment where Kirsten Dunst dies, sort of like, you know, they kind of switch roles, right? Like Kirsten regains her humanity, Jesse kind of like loses it in the process, right? It kind of beats you over the head with the message.
She becomes a media ogre. Yeah.
But I also saw it as different, right? It's sort of like the death of like traditional media versus like this independent journalist that just captured like both the moment where this like famous journalist dies, symbolizing what could be the death of traditional media. And then she captures the big photograph in the ending credits of the soldier celebrating the death of this fascist president. So
a photo that very clearly is like coded to be something that will be in history books forever. Like the U.S. military forces standing over a dead president that they just killed.
And again, it wasn't really Reuters that captured the story. It was this young, you know, girl that just hopped along for the ride and captured this incredible photograph with the help of no news agency.
I gotta say though, the fucking mobile development cans just like out in the middle of like the film. I don't know. I know that that's like small petty shit, but it reminds me a lot of the dog shit TV show, The Newsroom, where like it bothers me so much when like people get journalism stuff wrong, and maybe it's just from being in journalism. I don't know, but like
don't,
you still need
don't a, you turn into a comic book guy, man.
I don't want to be that, but like you still need a dark room. Like you still need the fucking dark room. You can't just do it in a football stadium. Like what the fuck?
You're not turning out any copy. David, no. Shut you down.
I was even
Nobody
willing
wants to see her in the dark room developing film.
I was even willing to forgive fucking dime store Pedro Pascal being like, oh, what's happening? Who is that? And it's like, wow, fucking incisive questions, bro. Good job. Great reporting, bro. What's going on? I'm being interviewed by the great fucking this guy.
Like, his question, I thought that too, man. Like his questions at every subject were awful.
Yeah.
Awful.
And he gets made fun of in the movie for doing just that.
One of the soldiers straight up, you know, I don't use this word, but it's funny. One of the soldiers literally calls them retarded.
Yeah.
Because so bad.
He's like, oh, I see. I mean, that was actually a funny scene, a lighthearted scene. Okay, so I wanted to ask you guys, we got to see another very realistic thing, by the way, was that the Acela corridor, completely unusable. They had to go all the way around. They had to go from New York to Pittsburgh, and then I guess like through West Virginia to DC, which I thought was pretty interesting. What part of the country did you guys most, if we ever revisited, if Alex Garland ever revisited this intellectual property, which parts of the US would you guys have liked to see represented in this movie? Obviously, I would say Florida, but I think things would be like weirdly peaceful here during this.
I thought the same thing.
Yeah.
I thought the same
But I don't know. What did you guys wish that we could have seen in this world that Alex Garland created of Civil War?
Somewhere around the... when things get like that, where like you have like abandoned cars in the road and you're weaving around, I'm not trying to turn. Yeah. Okay, I guess we all take our stab at comic book guy. The Great Lakes would be a prime source of fresh drinking water, and I guess I would want to see how that is, I guess, rationed out by either the military if they control it, or by Western forces if they control it. So I guess the Great Lakes region, which is a fun place to be, but could be a site of desperation in a situation like that.
I like to see the battle for the great liberal hellhole of San Francisco. No, I'm just kidding. I actually would have liked to see more scenes in D.C. because it just seems so chaotic and you know, like repressive. But also, like they you know, as you mentioned, I thought the Acela corridor not working was kind of like a statement in and of itself. But you know, they mentioned how Philadelphia is basically no man's land, so that seemed interesting. But yeah, I agree. Yeah. I thought you know, Miami would probably be like weirdly peaceful, but probably, you know, a very repressive place to live in.
My take on this is that when this actually does happen, if it ever did happen, I think that it won't break down on a state by state basis the way that we think it will. If you've visited a lot of cities throughout the middle of this country, you realize that pretty much every city in this country is generically liberal. Like Dallas is pretty liberal. Yeah. Houston is pretty liberal. Oklahoma City is pretty liberal. Like these are liberal places. And then, you know, obviously the politics are different in the outlying areas, but the place that I would love to see portrayed is a Kendall / like Westchester sprawling suburban area, because I feel like that's where the most bloodshed is going to be, because that's where the guns are, that's where everybody's fucking armed, everybody is armed in the suburbs throughout most of the country, and that's where you're mostly like, look on either side of me, my house in the suburbs, I have red-blooded conservative Cuban guy, right. Red-blooded conservative Cuban guy across the street, red-blooded conservative Venezuelan guy, like that's where you're going to see the most schism. And I would have loved to see like some sort of like suburbs gone to hell type of situation, regardless of the state. But I think the suburbs is where the violence is really going to happen when this shit happens. When this shit happens,
I would lay low and stop tweeting. I'll tell you that much.
And then the last thing I wanted to throw out there was Nick Offerman plays the president that we've mentioned a couple of times. He was obviously the epic bacon president, who is coded like very lightly coded as a Donald Trump character, but also clearly like in interviews, I saw that Nick Offerman was specifically saying he wasn't trying to channel Donald Trump. But I'm just wondering, apart from Trump, who was the clear, you know, impetus for this, for the clear inspiration for this character, what other political figures would you guys think could end up ascending to the presidency only to one day be gunned down in the Oval Office by separatists?
Oh, God.
And I have one in mind, and it's maybe a little obvious, but David, I want to hear
David,
from you guys.
David trying to get us on a terror watch list.
God. Yeah, this should be premium content for subscribers.
This is behind the paywall.
Ask us to name who we think are prime candidates to be assassinated.
Getting out of a no flight list is very difficult. I'm just warning you.
Who is the political figure today that would be the kookiest in office? How about that? That would be. I'll tell you mine.
Don't do it, David. David, just don't do it. Don't name a real person.
Drop it. Let's go.
This imaginary guy I've created named...
Tell us in chat. Don't do it.
Frat Bates. Okay. Frat Bates. Yeah. He's an imaginary senator. Imaginary...
Name names. I'll name you my name.
Okay.
Do it.
Yeah, go ahead. Oh, okay. No, mine is Matt Gaetz.
Gerald, you got to drop a name.
Wait, who did you say? Matt Gaetz. Who did you say?
No, Gerald, it's your turn.
Oh, you're saving yourself for last? Just
pushing you out onto that.
I'm actually not going to do it. I'm just imitating you guys.
Yeah, I'm not falling for that. But Thomas, I'm not falling for that.
I'm secure enough in my...
Tom Cotton?
Tom Cotton.
He's the one most likely to try to start a war that could go badly and try to bring that war home. Always, I can see that, yeah.
The dude's literally always writing about how we should violently repress everybody. But then again, I mean, you know, I don't want to be hyperbolic, but, you know, to my point that I made several times in this episode, you know, we have a Democratic president right now, and we literally have snipers on the roofs, fucking universities across the country, and students and professors, heads of departments, are getting the shit beat out of them by police. You know what I mean? I saw a video of like blood being cleaned after, you know, like these militarized police goons raided, you know, like one of these like peaceful encampments where students are just sleeping with tents after paying what, a $70,000 a year tuition fee. You know what I mean? So I don't know. Maybe we're living it right now.
Gerald just texted me. He said Joe Biden is definitely the one.
No, I did it. No, I did it. I'm choosing wisdom.
And then out of the three of us, who would be the most likely to try to transfer cars at high speeds on the like from window to window on a freeway?
I think it depends on what mood we're all in.
I can see T doing it. I've seen T in various in assorted states where he would do that. Yeah,
I do it 100%.
Okay, so how many buckets of popcorn do we give? I give it 1.5 buckets of popcorn.
Out of what?
Out of five?
Four. I always thought it was four. Oh. What, out of five, I'll give it two.
Okay.
How about that?
I'll give it two. Out of five, I give it three. I give it 3 out of 5.
Okay.
Tough crowd. Jesus.
No, I just didn't like it that much. There was moments I really liked, but not a whole lot of them.
They telegraphed way too much. Hey, guy who's clearly going to die. We're going on a suicide mission. It's crazy. Oh my God, he fucking died. How could we have known? Right. And it was like so... Like, come on.
Listener, don't listen to this Roger Ebert ass fucking.
Oh, the guy who loved movies more than anyone who ever lived. Don't listen to that.
The guy who did more to elevate the art form than any of us.
Four out of five popcorns. Go watch Civil War. It rocked. I give it 4 merely out of the fact that it wasn't 4 hours long. It's a brisk watch.
Points for that.
You're in and out, baby.